Welcome to episode 423 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode, I interview cycling coach and road cyclist Marinus Pedersen. As you can hear, I thought I would spice up the intro music as we're heading into a new era with That Triathlon Show, where episodes will no longer be released on a strict weekly schedule. Also, it's the new year, so there's that new year, new podcast, perhaps. I hope that you like the intro music, but if you hate it, don't stop listening to the podcast, please. Just email me and let me know. And if there's several people in that same boat, then I might change to the old intro music or something different if it's not a well-received change. I'm frankly not sure if I personally think it's better or worse or the same. I just thought that it's about time to change it up somehow. But whether this intro music is here to stay, I'm not super strongly convinced of. Also, a quick bit of a teaser. After the interview, I have an announcement that might be interesting for you. So listen 2 more minutes after the main interview is done to hear that and if it's relevant for you or not. But now, before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They help athletes personalize their hydration and fueling strategies for training and racing. You can use the free fuel and hydration planner to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake in your next event. And if you want even more help, why not book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with the athlete support team. As a TTS listener, you get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Zen8. The Zen8 indoor swim trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. You can target specific aspects of your stroke, like catch and pull through, and work on technique or power or both. The design of the bench forces you to constantly work on core activation, which can help your body position in the water. And most importantly, you can stay consistent in your training even when you don't have time to get to the pool. Try the Zen8 risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zenitswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Marinus Pedersen. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Marinus. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you, Michael. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. It's one of the last days before Christmas as we're recording this, even though it will be released a little bit later. But yeah, just wrapping up some things here before the holiday season. But let's start with an introduction to yourself. Who are you?
So I'm the founder, owner, and sole coach of Kilowatt Coaching, my own small coaching business. I'm also a racing cyclist myself, so competing in road cycling. I was racing with a French team next year, moving out to France to race. And in the past, I've won some national races in the UK, and my biggest result would be winning the Welsh Road Race Championship. So, I'm a cyclist and a cycling coach.
All right, yeah. What would you say in terms of the cyclists that you coach? What kind of athletes are you working with? Amateurs of different disciplines, or are you focusing more on road or something specific?
Yeah, so most of my clients have raced road and gravel races, but I've had people racing time trials, ultra endurance, mountain bike, cyclocross, hill climb, which is kind of like a specific discipline we just have mostly in the UK. And and consulted with some triathletes as well, because I do one-to-one coaching, but also consultations.
All right. Yeah. So let's start with if you can give an overview of your coaching methodology and philosophy.
Okay. So this is it's quite a hard question to both interpret and then articulate, but I've tried to do a bit of planning, so hopefully this makes some sense. So kind of the factors I first like integrate is like the individual athlete's like physiology, their personality, their lifestyle, what training resources they have, like, you know, facilities they have access to, and then also their previous training history. And then we look at like the event, the demands of their event and those goals. And we kind of like work back, like, how can we best pair the athlete for that, those events and goals. At that point, I then, you know, apply my own experience and my knowledge of the, you know, scientific evidence. And I'm quite clear at this point with my clients that, you know, I'm only making my best guess at what I think is going to like get you to this get you to your, you know, get the best results for you. And then it's kind of an iterative process of, you know, like finding what the outcome is and then refining the process based on how that goes. Because I'd say I have most success with the athletes I get to work with for longer, and I get to learn more about what does and doesn't work for them and them as a person. And then, yeah, it was kind of repeat that in a sort of cyclical pattern. So yeah, it's dynamic and changing over time. And I have a really close integration of nutrition. So like I do struggle to kind of disentangle the two. For example, like if I'm going to get someone to do threshold or, you know, any kind of medium intensity work where it's really important for the adaptation, like that, what work someone can do, and the difference between them being able to say do, you know, 2x20 or 2x, you know, like 3x20 could, it just can be as simple as, you know, how many carbohydrates they eat in the 24 hours before. So for me to like not like include that as part of the coaching process, I feel like would be, you know, a real disservice when I know how important it is. So yeah, and in general, people who start with me, I tend to get them to do more volume, either in hours or in kilojoules, which we can talk about more, and less kind of intensity days. So yeah, like in days where any of the training is above the first lactate threshold. And then the final thing, which I think I'll touch on in this, is that, yeah, prioritize consistency. And if you work back from that, that means you're really focusing on, you know, health, general health, hygiene, and then general robustness from, you know, including strength and conditioning. So I think those are kind of like really important if, yeah, working backwards from what allows you to consistently train at high volume with an appropriate amount of intensity to progress over the long term.
Yeah, I think you did a great job articulating that. So well done. Maybe let's start to discuss that nutrition aspect, which I think is, as you say, like it's hard to disentangle that from the training itself. But can you give some practical tips for, other than just, you already mentioned that, okay, how many carbs you eat 24 hours before can have an impact on the session that you do and how well you do it. How do you work with clients? Is it more when you have calls with them, you discuss this, you ask what they're doing, and then you give some tips for maybe how they can improve it if what they are doing is not maybe as good as it could be? Or do you have specific notes within their training plan for during training and before and outside of training? How does it work?
So a little bit of it, first of all, is kind of on a needs basis. If someone's really nailing it already, then I might not have to, it might just be smaller refinements. Or equally, it does depend a bit on the ambition of the client and what goals they come to with me. So, you know, if they come to me and they say, I want to be world tour, I'm going to be like, well, you know, we're going to do everything to optimize your nutrition as much as possible. If someone, you know, only has, you know, a less smaller amount of time to ride and, you know, they're less ambitious, then I'll just say, you know, just make sure you're having lots of carbohydrates before this session, and, you know, we might not delve into it as much. In general, I find that, like, yeah, even some people who've competed at quite high level and been on world tour teams that I've worked with are really bad at fueling, like, for the work required, and thinking like less so about what was my previous training session, but more forward thinking to what the next training session is. So what you'll find is like some people get home and think, oh, I've done a really long ride today, burnt a lot of energy. I need to get in this massive amount of food before, like, I go to bed, which, you know, can compromise sleep and just, yeah, many downsides, and then almost like starving themselves on rest days. Whereas if you kind of, even just from a point of view of thinking about absorption of nutrients, like to kind of move that energy intake, like, more evenly across the week. So this can look like, you know, taking in really quite a lot of food and a lot of carbohydrate on rest and recovery days leading into like a harder session. Cause most of the time, if someone has a rest or recovery day, I'll then, it'll be something hard the next day. So, prioritizing, yeah, like getting in enough, carbohydrate to fuel the next day's session. So I'd say that's kind of the main thing. And once you can start like educating someone on like what muscle glycogen is, because I think there's a lot of terms kind of thrown around and people think, oh, just fueling, glycogen, glucose, like it's all the same. Whereas if you can kind of understand that like muscle glycogen is like, yeah, like what it is and how you can actually manipulate it with nutrition, and that, you know, for example, like how much you eat on a ride, it does nothing to top up your glycogen stores. Like you can't do that during exercise, so it really is all about, you know, the day or the couple of days before. So yeah, I'd say that's kind of one of the most important things I start with.
You can go on if you have more points.
I prescribe people what to like take on rides, so like as in how much carbohydrate, and try and educate them around how you've got your glucose, your SGLT1 is the transport protein for glucose in the small intestine, which is the rate limiting step. And then we've got fructose, GLUT5 that transports fructose. So yeah, if you want to go up to 120 grams of carbs an hour, you need to try and saturate both these proteins. And so this is my theory. No, I've never actually heard anyone say it before. I think a lot of why fructose is a lot less well tolerated is because we have a much smaller amount of fructose in our habitual diet. Like even stuff like a lot of fruits won't be like 100% fructose based carbohydrate. So you'll find most people can quite quickly go to 60 grams an hour of glucose and they don't have any, whether they're oxidizing all of that, we don't know, but they definitely aren't having as much, issues, GI issues, whereas the fructose tends to cause problems. So something I quite often do is prescribe people to go do 60 grams an hour of fructose only, so that you can like really train that GLUT5 fructose receptor without overfueling some shorter and or easier sessions. So that's something which I think is a lot of people don't, you know, like, yeah, could benefit from doing.
And do you do that? Do you do that with just store-bought fructose mixed into water? Because that would, I imagine, get very, very sweet. Do you mix something else in there? So practical tips for how to consume 60 grams an hour of pure fructose?
Yeah, well, I just mix it with water, and I think it tastes like honey plus.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like really nice honey, and yeah, you can get really creative with mixing other stuff with it. Or you could cheap orange or apple juice is, you know, nearly all fructose. So if you like, fructose powder is a cheaper way of doing it, and then you're really maximally stripping back on the fiber, small trace elements of fiber and protein that you don't want. But yeah, so I'd just buying fructose powder. It's like part of my kilowatt coaching starter pack alongside maltodextrin. Big bags of maltodextrin.
Yeah. No, that is for sure a good practical tip for also just for in general being able to fuel large amounts of training, maltodextrin and fructose power. That's just a very cheap way of getting through long hours of training and not neglecting fuel, because it gets too expensive if you fuel all of that with gels.
Yeah, and if the other good tip, if you're traveling or it's inconvenient to carry around your massive bags of fructose or fructose powder or maltodextrin, is to just use table sugar, because that's actually got a 1-to-1 ratio of glucose and fructose. It isn't quite as well absorbed because there's an enzyme and you have to break down the sucrose into glucose and fructose. But I'd say for general training and endurance rides, that's what I use most of the time. So then I don't have to weigh out on my scales to get the ratios right. I just tip out the bag of sugar. And then if I'm traveling, you know, you can get white caster sugar in pretty much any shop. So that's a lot more convenient, and it's also really cheap. And, you know, I've known one of my friends has had many of his best race results in UCI races just racing off sugar. It's like, all these sports nutrition companies is really just marketing, and I think a lot of people could benefit from saving money on that and spending it on good coaching instead.
I still like those products, but I do agree that for a lot of general training, you can save the money, and I think that there's still a place for that, but it doesn't have to be like what you use in your everyday in training for sure. Were there any other points about nutrition that you were that you wanted to discuss?
Yeah, so I do like to encourage people to use, first of all, supplements to address any nutritional deficiencies. So to get blood work done to look for iron and vitamin D in most northern hemisphere countries throughout the winter. And then also supplements I use for performance are creatine if someone's doing a block of gym work and or some sprint or anaerobic capacity efforts. Which is, I also think there's a lot of benefits for, because it's got like for health and even cognitive, performance, it seems to have some benefit. So I don't think there's any downside to taking creatine other than when you're racing and perhaps you don't want the weight gain associated with it. But just for general training, I think creatine's so cheap. I think there's not a lot of downsides to being on it. And then if a client feels they've got bandwidth, time, energy to take beta-alanine, because it is, you know, a bit more of a faff. You have to take it 3 or even 4 doses a day. But I do think for like, say, VO2 max efforts and in that, you know, shorter efforts in the kind of 2 to 10 minute range, it can really improve the power you're able to do. And I think that can then consequently drive better adaptations as a result. And then the final thing I want to touch on is that I do look at I'm not dismissive about addressing someone's weight or body composition issues. Like just as a performance parameter to address. And so, yeah, with a lot of my clients, that means gaining weight. Sometimes for health, sometimes for performance, like putting on muscle. Sometimes it means reducing body fat to optimize power to weight ratio. I just see that as another kind of performance parameter that I'm looking to optimize. I think a lot of coaches, like you can look at just like the data you see is the data from like someone's like sessions, their power meter. And if you don't concern yourself with weight, like then you can, yeah, perhaps like as a coach, it's easy to just say always eat more, because that's the easy thing to say. And then like, oh, look, the training goes better. But, you know, if someone is doing a weight dependent event, then like it is actually something that you might need to address it. Hit several phases of the training cycle. So it's something I also consider and periodize.
For which kind of events do you think that is more important, being more, let's say, weight conscious among your clientele? Obviously the hill climbs would be one, I assume.
Yeah, for hill climbs. And also just hilly road races and hilly gravel events. I think, your weight just has an impact. So I think like when you think of any cycle event, first of all, like you've kind of got what I call like your holy trinity of power, weight and aero. And that both changes from like event to event, and even changes like within an event. So, you know, if you're going up a really steep hill, aero is nothing. It's only power and weight. If you're going on the flat at a high speed, then you know, weight makes zero difference at all. And it's just about power and aero. If you're going on descent at 100k an hour, even power doesn't make a thing. It's all just about aero and tucking in. So it's yeah, just that's kind of my framework that I use to then consider like which of those variables to focus more or less on with the client.
Yeah. What about hydration? Is that something you focus on?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think in general, just maintaining good hydration all the time is important. And yeah, so at Loughborough, I worked with my Lewis James, who did a lot of the like pioneering work on hydration, was my supervisor for my final year project. And if you look at his research, what he found is that around 2-3% of body mass is where you start to see performance decrement. So what I do with a lot of my athletes is before a race, we collect various data about their sweat rate. And this is something I think this is really basic that a lot of self-coached athletes could do, is you literally just weigh yourself, like just in your cycling kit, say before a ride, weigh everything that you eat and drink on that ride. Then weigh yourself after, and then you can calculate your sweat rate. And if you do that in a few different intensities, a few different environmental conditions, you can start to build up a picture of an athlete's sweat rate. And then, for example, if they're going to do a 4-hour race or even a 4-hour training session or whatever X hours it is, then you can kind of calculate how much do I need to be drinking to make sure that at the end of that race, I'm not at, I'm not past this threshold where I'm likely going to incur performance detriment. So if it's a 2-hour race, very often we'll find that there is no real point in drinking, because as long as you start in a dehydrated state, that you're still going to be, within that threshold when you finish. Whereas if you're doing an 8-hour ultra endurance gravel event, then you're going to have to be really close to replacing your sweat rate, because even if the delta between your sweat rate and your intake is only like 300 mil an hour, 300 mil times 8 hours is actually, approaching, for some people that would be 2,400 mil, and then you can be starting to see performance detriment. So if someone's in the case where they're really high sweater, like they've got a really high sweat rate, then, and it's not physically going to be possible for them to take in enough water over the course of their event because of practical reasons, or they simply couldn't stomach it, then I think an intervention that is very powerful, but you do have to be careful with, is actually familiarizing yourself with training and in that dehydrated state. So if you look at some research, there's, again, that Lewis did on treadmill running, he found that if you familiarize yourself with running in a dehydrated state, that yes, you never will perform as well in that dehydrated state as you would if you were euhydrated, but the delta between your euhydrated and dehydrated, or hyperhydrated, the proper word, is smaller. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because I would have almost imagined that that's one of those things that you almost cannot compensate for. So I hadn't heard of that research. So really, really interesting to know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if you look at a lot of top performances, say like Haile Gebrselassie's famously finished marathon, like, I don't know what, 10%.
10%, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's not something you need to, a lot of athletes don't need to do a specific block of, like, just by doing habitual training at a higher volume, like a lot of people are getting used to training in a dehydrated state inadvertently a lot of the time anyway. So, that can be something to be aware of. And I think the final thing I'll touch on, and nutrition, is that I think it's quite common with athletes to kind of have what I'll call like orthorexic tendencies. And orthorexic, it sounds kind of like anorexia, sounds like someone's got a problem, but I think it's more of a societal thing in that people think, oh, you have to eat healthy foods all the time. And if we think of like what healthy food is, it's something that has like very low calorific density and very high micronutrient density. So if you think when you're an athlete, you need food, you need a lot of energy, but you don't need, so like your energy demands, if you're training at high volume, might be two, even close to three times a sedentary person. But like the amount of micronutrients you need doesn't scale up anywhere near that much, and maybe, yeah, barely at all. So you don't need to eat like, you know, three avocados if a normal person needs one a week. Like, so, and a lot of most nutrients scale with total food volume. So if you're an athlete trying to get in enough calories without like being bloated from too high of a fiber intake, or like just having food that is overly satiating, you need to have food that is perhaps more like unhealthy, that is a lower, like less satiating, higher energy density, and a lower micronutrient density is fine, because you just need to get the energy in. So I think, yeah, sometimes athletes do a disservice to themselves by thinking they have to eat healthy food all the time, always brown rice, always oats, and actually sometimes the more refined foods can be really useful.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah, let's move on to another topic. So one thing we discussed over email was endurance rides. So what you mentioned of prescribing oversized endurance rides. So I'll let you describe exactly how that works. But yeah, let's take the lead from there. What are oversized endurance rides in your mind?
So I think a lot of people kind of have like a hard limit on the ride length of about 6 hours. And apart from anything else, just I think like if, yeah, applying progressive overload at some point and doing 7 or 8 hour endurance rides is really powerful. And also the way I look at what drives endurance, like adaptations from sub LT1 work, is not the like how many hours you're sat on a bike, and is more so the total work done. So for example, like, yeah, and then all training has a cost benefit. And I think, for example, if you can get the same work done in 7 hours rather than 6 hours by riding at an even lower intensity, then you can have even less neuromuscular fatigue. You can fuel closer to your energy requirements. Or the other way is, you just by doing a longer ride, you can get more total work done if you keep the intensity higher. So I think what I find is, by going even longer and sometimes even slower, like people can get more adaptation and then also be fresher for the higher intensity sessions. Or if we're in a phase of training where we're just really trying to move the needle on LT1, for example, then we can even do these 7 or even 8 hour rides with blocks of time right close to LT1, and yeah, just maximize the total work done that someone's able to do. Does that,
that's very clear. So how often would you do them with, let's assume that it's an athlete that has time, obviously, to do them, and they are probably an ambitious cyclist, because most cyclists that aren't quite ambitious would probably not ride for 7-8 hours. But if we have those things in place, then how often might you look at doing those sorts of rides?
So it depends on, yeah, where someone is in there with their training history, and also their time availability. But yes, anywhere between 5 times a week and once a month. So like with some people, what I also find, there's another big benefit of these oversized rides is that, as we were discussing earlier, like for any training session, there's a lot of like faff time either side. And so for like a lot of time restricted people, I say like, I'd rather you made that that ride on the weekend, 7 hours or 8 hours even. And then that when you're time crunched in the week, you just did 1 hour rather than like squeezing to try and fit in 90 minutes or 2 hours. Because I think there's a lot of benefits that you get when you're extending this duration, because you're training in a glycogen depleted state, like in those last hours of a longer endurance ride. So if someone can do the same total volume, but in like more dense, with longer rides in, including these longer rides, then I say if time is limiting, I'd rather you do that. And I think the other benefit around the scheduling point of it is it can allow you to have more like recovery days in the week. So it can say you could have 3 like oversized rides, and then you've got like 4 recovery, potentially have 4 recovery days, or like shorter easy recovery days there, which can leave you fresher for your high intensity. So there's a lot of ways I'd play about it, and it all depends on periodization, the athlete's time commitments, and various other factors. But consistent feedback I've had from people doing it is they're terrified of the idea at first. They just think, oh no, 6 hours is bad enough, I couldn't do 7 or 8. But actually you're like, no, just take it really chill. You can go somewhere you probably never normally get to go, because you can do a massive loop, and you know, just fuel really high, and you'll feel great the whole time because you're riding easy and you're eating loads of Haribos or whatever it is you like to eat. I found it working really well.
Would you always recommend bringing a handlebar bag for those rides to be able to fit the Haribos? Because I have some experience riding with Haribos in my pockets, but even with big pockets for 78 hours, I feel like you get to the limit of how much you can stuff in there.
Yeah. Also, a few ways I do it is I quite often get like a little freezer bag with my carbohydrate powder, and then like put that in my saddle bag, and then I know where the various taps are in the area, and then I'll once my bottles are empty, I'll put the powder in that and then fill it up with the tap. Because linking back to something we said earlier about consistency, like say you want to stop at a garage or somewhere, once you're like getting towards the end of that ride, if you're in a glycogen depleted state, it can be quite risky to do. So I advise people to either use like the tap kind of method with carrying your bags of sugar around, or what I sometimes do, and what some of my clients will do is just have a second set of bottles and do like 2 loops. So do like a 4-hour loop and then another 3 or 4 hour loop. And that, because you like time efficiency is quite important on these days. It's like, especially with the daylight, you have to like be really on it and organized. That can help as well. And even breaking it down mentally, so like, oh, I'll just do 4 hours, and then you quickly swap over and then do another 4 or another 3. So just to illustrate the point, and that it can leave you really fresh despite doing this big volume and these longer rides. I've done my best 5-minute power like with 1 recovery day after an 8-hour ride before, and just like so many and then I won one of my biggest races last year at the end of that week, you know, with multiple 7 and 8 hour rides in there. So if people are concerned about the fatigue it generates, if you're doing it properly, you're riding easy enough and you're eating enough, it's actually surprising how fatiguing it isn't. If that makes any sense.
It especially when you said that you can do it anywhere from 5 times a week to once a month, it reminded me of Niels van der Poel's How to Skate a 10K, where 5 times a week of 6 to 8 hours of riding was kind of part and parcel of his training for skating and setting world records and taking Olympic goals. So that was that's for those that haven't read that was an interesting case study of some extreme training, but that worked extremely well for him. So what about people that do, let's say people that don't have time to do oversized endurance rides, but your typical athlete might be doing 2.5 to 5, even 6 hours every once in a while. Do you prescribe a different kind of execution? Like when you talked about the total work being a driver of adaptation, would you prescribe maybe a slightly higher effort or power or heart rate for those sorts of rides than you would for those really long rides?
Yeah. So again, the way I look at what drives adaptation within sub LT1 work is that total work done. And then you kind of have someone's like the constraints of someone's time, and then also like their effective fatigue budget. So, or like the fatigue that you will allow that ride to generate. So that'll depend on where it is in the cycle and how much load that person can tolerate. And then it's down to what is like the least fatiguing way of getting the most work done given that fatigue budget. So if someone's really time restricted and they can only ride for 90 minutes and we're doing an endurance ride, then I'll pin that like right close to LT1, or giving that some margin for error, because you're always better off being slightly under versus slightly over. And when you work out the total work done, say like 10 watts within a 1 hour ride, how much longer you have to ride to get the same total work done, it's like, you know, 5 minutes or something. So that's another thing I'd say to people, is that even if you can only do like an extra 10 minutes like on each endurance ride, 10 minutes 6 days a week is an hour a week, which is, you know, 50 hours a year. And 50 hours a year is something that you could, you know, quite say is going to be meaningful to increasing your mitochondrial density and all this good stuff, which we know is going to improve your performance. So yeah, generally the shorter the ride, the closer you can go to LT1 with generating less fatigue. But I'd say what I don't like people to do is head out and start riding really close to LT1 right from the start, and then realizing, oh, actually this is, I'm too tired for this today, and then they end up doing a lot less. So what I quite often prescribe is, say someone's got 2.5 hours, I might say, you know, start off in more like a 2 out to 3 out of 10 RPE pace, and then as you kind of start to warm up and open up, then gradually ramp that up towards like a 4 or 5 out of 10. And well, I spend a lot of time with people both testing what their LT1 is and then like describing what it looks and feels like, and just making sure that, yeah, they know how to ride close to that whilst making sure they're under it.
How, maybe we can discuss that. How do you test that, and how do you describe the feeling?
Okay, so one test I've started using more recently, actually, which I found seems to work very well and align with people's sensations of what they say their LT1 is I just get them to, so it works best on the trainer and using erg mode, although I have had some people do it out on the road. So we take whatever you think your LT1 is, and then we knock off, say, like 30 watts, and then ride easy for, say, 30 minutes to 2 hours, whatever, depending on how much time you got. And then we'll do just 10-minute stages of riding a constant cadence, and like, on erg mode is kind of ideal, and then just increase the power 10 watts a minute. And then what I find is that if you look at the decoupling within those 10-minute stages, someone will start to decouple nearly always that first stage that's over LT1. I wouldn't say this is like a fail-safe method. So I then tie that back to, you know, what was, like, what, where did you feel your LT1 was? But I found very often this is kind of given pretty good resolution. And then, like I say, when we actually then apply that in the real world, I'll always knock off another 10 watts again, and to give margin for error. So, and then as to like describing, yeah, what LT1 feels like, it's kind of the highest power that feels sort of effortless in a way, because, it's like, yeah, your blood lactate, your fatigue metabolites should be, you know, no different to what they are at rest. And you should be able to, yeah, hold, hold a conversation. Like your breathing will be somewhat elevated, and effort level is elevated, you know, from on a spectrum from like 0 watts rest to riding at LT1. So it's, you know, it will be some effort, and especially as your LT1 becomes higher, it can be quite heavy on the legs. But like, I think you should be able to, you know, sing a few tunes. So I've collected an archive of my clients singing whilst they do their blocks of riding closer to LT1, just to, you know, make sure they've ticked the test. One final thing, which I think is quite powerful, is it's like, I think you can notice when you've done like any type of intensity and you've had that disturbance to your autonomic nervous system, you almost kind of feel like a bit high and a bit like pumped up off it. And whereas if you kept it under LT1, when you finish the session, you might be calmer and you're feeling happier, but you're not like today I've done intervals and you can tell I'm a bit like zapped. Whereas when you've kept it sub LT1, you kind of just feel calm. It's not like, yeah, you've been electrocuted almost. I don't know. It's a feeling that I think you can recognize, and you can get better at recognizing as you gather more training experience.
But I do think it's a very important thing that you said, that as you get fitter and your LT1 gets higher, then the sensations do change, and it gets harder, especially muscularly. So somebody who is just starting out as a cyclist will probably have a very low LT1, and they will tend to easily go above it, whereas somebody who is very fit and has a very high LT1, they will be much less likely. That depends a bit of I've in my experience on the athlete profile as well, but a lot of really fit athletes would be very far from it as their kind of natural intensity versus the less fit athletes. But yeah, I think that's the test that you described is really interesting, and then also another key point there is that you have that margin for error as well, and focusing on keeping a bit below rather than overshooting it a bit, if that's the objective of the session. So yeah, lots of good points there.
Yeah, I think the final important point on that is that your LT1 will deteriorate. It's just slightly different day to day, and it'll also deteriorate across the course of a longer ride. And yeah, the factors like fueling and hydration will affect this, but also just your durability. So if you can feel LT1 by your heart rate and RPE, that's very important, because you don't want to be, especially for people who've, you know, done less volume and are less well trained, their LT1 might deteriorate by as much as 20% by, you know, even the fourth hour of an endurance ride. So what might be a comfortable pace at the start could actually be tempo effectively by the end, and the last thing we want is to be having like intensity days that were unintentional.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Other than the LT1 test, what other testing and different kinds of ways of profiling athletes do you use?
I just tend to test people at various power durations, different power tests. So I like to do a kind of test in the 4 to 6 minute range. I like to do a longer test in the 20 to 40 minute range. And I also like to see someone's kind of sprint anaerobic capacity in the kind of 30 second to 2 minute. I think critical power can work quite well as a model if you've got a longer test in there. And then that gives a good estimate of you can get a good estimate of someone's anaerobic capacity then as well. I like to have that longer test is quite critical, which I in general just give people 40 minutes, but it depends on their training status. Sometimes I've had people just kind of feel about where their FTP is and just go for it as long as they can. And I've had some ultra endurance guys do 70 minutes at their FTP. But then some, like say newer athletes with less of a training history, I kind of want to see where that threshold is, but I know they're not so familiar with pacing or even just like the muscular load of pushing themselves for that long amount of time. So we might start off with a 20 or 30 minute test. It might be more appropriate for them. So it depends on the athlete, really.
Yeah. And how does this, in what ways does the testing inform training decisions?
So I think it can be good to look at whether someone is more like centrally or peripherally limited. So whether they're more limited by their VO2 max or whether they're just need to work more on their fractional utilization. So if someone's done a lot of volume and not much intensity, then perhaps they might need to focus more on methods to target the central side of their VO2 max, perhaps with some heat training or some VO2 max efforts or a combination of the two. Or quite often you find with people with less of a training history, they can improve for a very long time by doing one intensity day or less a week and just really increasing their volume. And doing some middle intensity work, threshold and sweet spot stuff can be really, really good for that as well. And then the having someone's anaerobic capacity is also useful because in cycling, and I guess in Olympic distance triathlon, that is very important. And for some people, it can be a weakness. For some people, it can be a strength, and we don't need to work on it as much. And I also think that having a higher anaerobic capacity allows you to more effectively increase your VO2 max and VO2 max efforts. So again, why I might encourage someone to supplement creatine and or beta-alanine, we might also do a block of anaerobic capacity efforts. Because if you think when you hit close to VO2 max, like a lot of what's allowing you to stay there and sustain that for longer is that anaerobic capacity. And a good example I use of this is, 1500 meter runners, they hit VO2 max by the time they've gone through 300 meters, and yet they carry on running another three laps. With some ultra endurance guys who've got, say, like very little VO2 max at all, very little anaerobic capacity, they get to VO2 max and it's like, then that's it. They've got nothing and they can't sustain it for very long. So that'll change prescription of VO2 max type training. And it also might mean that I prioritize development of anaerobic capacity with some people more or less than others.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. Use similar, take similar decisions based on testing and specifically, the tests of different duration. I mean, I tend to, see it as a formal critical power test, but even if you don't see it, do it as formal testing, you just test different durations, you get the same information, of course. Yeah. So that makes sense. When you look at limitations being peripheral or central, how do you determine that specifically?
So I think looking at someone's LT1 can be a good test, and also just looking at the gap between taking their anaerobic capacity into account, like the gap between their power in like a shorter range, say like 4 to 10 minute, and their power at like 30 plus minutes. And if there's like a really big gap there, and their LT1 is lower, then it's likely that they're more peripherally limited.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, one more question about testing. What do you think that are some common mistakes that athletes make when it comes to testing and also using the testing to inform their own training?
Yeah. So back to the power testing over various durations, like making sure that data is like good and consistent. So for example, like you find a lot of people who say they can do a shorter test, like they've got a 5 minute hill, they can do an all out 5 minute out on the road. But they don't have a 20 minute climb or even anything more than 10 minutes. So their power for that longer test will kind of artificially look a lot lower than their shorter test. And then you could perhaps falsely interpret that they were more peripherally limited when in fact that wasn't as much the case. So I think like if you can keep the environment consistent, like in what the data you're putting into the model. That's very important. And then I think also just like to then kind of make implications about someone's athlete profile from that, and then assume this must be the case when in fact it isn't necessarily like. I guess I'm going on more to, if you think someone's more, say, fast or slow twitch dominant, and therefore they might respond well to this or that type of training, not to just assume that, because sometimes it isn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, exactly. Like understanding the uncertainty in you might have a hypothesis, but understanding that it might not be correct, and
yeah,
just trying to be attentive to things, that observations that might disprove your hypothesis, essentially.
Mm, yeah, exactly that. Yeah, yeah.
All right. So then you mentioned a little bit already about that a lot of people that you work with, you have them do more volume than you used to and less intensity. Mm. What would you say, especially with balancing intensity and volume, but and also recovery rest days? If you could kind of boil that down into a few practical tips for people to take away, what would you say?
Okay. So I guess
to make that question a bit easier, more specific, maybe. Yeah. Firstly, on the intensity side, frequency of intensity during the training week, do you have rules of thumb there? And that they might be a bit different for different types of athletes, but
yeah. So I never give anyone, or I never have, maybe I will in the future, given anyone more than 3 intensity days a week. But I have used double days for VO2 max and even for other types of intensity. Like I've had someone do, I frequently have one client do, like, say, VO2 max in the morning and then a Zwift race in the evening. But I like to keep the total number of intensity days less than 3. And I very rarely do 3. Most of the time, it'll be either 1 or 2 intensity days. And so with a lot of my clients, especially when they're newer, I'll peg them back to doing 1 intensity day so that we can really maximize the amount of work done they can get from the endurance riding, and then back to rest and recovery, and give them like 2 recovery days before their high intensity session. You can make sure you really hit that hard. Because I like to, if I'm going to make someone do any kind of intensity at all, whether it's middle or higher intensity, I want to make sure it's actually worth doing, and not just kind of just throw it in there because of this vague idea that you want to have X amount of intensity days. So I'll make sure they're actually fresh for it. They can actually hit it hard and get the adaptations you want to from that session. And if not, then we just ride endurance. So I like to, have blocks where I kind of turn the needle on the volume of work done we can get from the endurance riding, and then other periods where we turn that dial back by either riding less hours or riding those hours easier, and then increasing the amount of high intensity days we do to 2 or
3,
and maybe some double days in there as well.
Yeah. And about the recovery, so do you have a rule of thumb for how many easier days you would have in a week, and also thoughts on active recovery versus complete rest days?
Yeah, so I generally give someone at least 2 recovery days, like not necessarily in a week, but at least, in like an 8-day period or something. So quite often if people are full-time, we'll do like 3 days on recovery day, 3 days on recovery day. And I do also like to give someone like a complete day off, at least, not necessarily every week, but most weeks. For like the sort of the mental benefits, if nothing else. And I also really dislike the sort of Andy Coggan model of like saying there's a zone 1 and a zone 2, where it implies there's some discrete point like below which you're recovering and you're not doing anything. You're not training at all, and there's some point above which you're not recovering and you're doing training. So like, if you do, like a 20-minute ride in like mid zone 2, that probably will constitute like a recovery day. If you do 6 hours, like 10 watts below your zone two, then that is not a recovery day. So I like to have, in general, I'll have someone do like a shorter, I don't like to call it recovery ride, but effectively that's what I do call it, because I want them to just take it really easy and make sure it's short. So like a sort of 60 to 90 minute like recovery ride, and then a full rest day. And like when I have like recovery periods, which I tend to give someone every 3 to 6 weeks, we'll do a lot of this, yeah, like sort of recovery type rides where it's just, you know, like 1 out of 10 RPE taking it really easy.
No, I'm with you there. And I think that like the terminology that we're using in cycling and in endurance sports is often at best confusing and at worst very misleading. and that part with zone one recovery is definitely one that I dislike. I started calling, if I use like a 5-zone system or a 6-zone system in power zones, then I still call zone one, I call it easy endurance, and zone two would be steady endurance, but it's all endurance. So it's just a kind of specifier before, but it's not recovery, because if you're on the bike, you're still on the bike to get some kind of training stimulus. And okay, maybe it's just a very light stimulus and it's light enough that it will allow you to recover throughout the rest of the day. But it's not, I haven't seen anything that would indicate that you're actually recovering faster by being on the bike than by just actually being in bed or on the couch or something like that. So if you actually just want to recover, then you probably shouldn't be on the bike.
Yeah, although like most people find that they feel awful after a complete rest day. Not all my clients, some do. So I tend to never give anyone a full rest day before anything hard.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think that a lot of people need just a longer warm up the day after a complete rest day, and then that can solve things. But yeah, I mean, with some people, sure, yeah, that I do agree with that. But yeah, anyway, so moving on to periodization, what are your thoughts on periodization? How do you use it?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people over prioritize it in what matters most, but I do still think it is important. And the one thing I'd say, which I definitely is true, is that you want to work from more general to more specific. So more specific as you get closer to your goal event, and like more general as you're further away from it. So for example, I'll focus after someone's off-season break, furthest away from their goal events, that's when we'll do gym work, the most gym work, and focus on that the most, because lifting weights is not specific to racing a bike. It's not even riding a bike. So, I think I like to spend most of the training period like working on someone's VO2 max, or like at least kind of working on the peripheral limiters of that. And then like the sort of middle intensity work, it has specificity for most endurance events. So I think that specific endurance can, if you've got a really good base, that can train quite quickly in a month or two. So I'd rather spend like most of the training phase like working on what's the limiters to actually making their thresholds as high as possible, and then like extending the time they can do that. So how often can they repeat efforts that they'll have to do on a climb in a race, or you know, how long can they spend at their threshold for like a time trial or something? That kind of TTE work, if you like. I think that can be improved on very quickly, and I don't like to waste too many intensity days on it doing loads of it throughout the year, when I'd rather make someone's threshold higher than spend like loads of time improving how long they can ride at their threshold, because yeah, I don't know, it's kind of what am I trying to say?
I see what you're saying though, like you can waste some time if you work too much in those middling intensities, if you don't have the framework in place to you know, to race it further, and the best you can hope for is just holding it for longer. So spending some more time on building the capacity to race it further in the future when you do go to that intensity, to threshold intensity with VO2 max work. That is that kind of the gist of it.
Yeah, and I think in someone like you, I think you can get, other than the specific endurance in like the sort of the fast twitch muscles that you're looking for to improve that endurance, I think you can get all of the kind of peripheral adaptations that are going to increase the size of your threshold and your VO2 max that you get from that middle intensity work by doing more volume if you do enough of it. So if someone's more time restricted, then like in sort of like, earlier phases of training, where in someone who's less time restricted, we might just, you know, ride 30, 35 hours a week. It like that middle intensity work can be quite useful, but I still wouldn't look to that first of all. First of all, I look to just spend more time riding closer to LT1. So it's, there's a balance and there's lots of different factors in there, but I just try to think really carefully about when I ask someone to do intensity and not ask them to do it for no big reason.
When you do VO2 max work, do you have, like, do you find that there's what do you find is the limit for how many sessions, let's say? Obviously that maybe depends on how frequently you do them, but if you do two VO2 max sessions a week, let's say, how many weeks do you find that people can do it for and before you need to kind of rest a bit?
I've never seen anyone do more than 3 weeks of consistent VO2 max efforts without needing to rest.
Yeah.
Because I think the quality is important, and once the quality starts to really go, and I don't like to push people into overreaching, because I don't think that has benefits.
And when you say that you've never seen anybody do more than 3 weeks, does that mean what is the average? Is it more like 2 weeks, or do the average person get to 3 weeks and that's kind of it?
Yeah, people can get to three, but like I don't. It's perfectly fine if someone only do two. Or quite often I will mix in, like do kind of mixed blocks, or doing some medium intensity and also VO2 max at the same time. If someone's only doing one session a week of it, for example, actually, I take back what I just said, because I quite often have people doing one session a week whilst otherwise doing a lot of volume or doing gym or trying to lose weight. So like having some other stresses, but then having that one VO2 max session a week, I find that works really well. And then I've seen people do 4 or 5 weeks, but when it's one session a week, it's a different story.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's kind of, I think that's kind of what I also seen with the number of sessions, depending on how you spread it out. Like you can do, I see a lot of people can do 6 sessions, but it can be 3 sessions a week for 2 weeks or 2 sessions a week for 3 weeks. And obviously 6 weeks of one session a week, but that seems to be quite a common number that you get to before you kind of see signs that you're at least getting into the area of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
And what about aerodynamics? How do you work on that? How do you factor that into the training?
It depends on someone's event, how important it is. But what I do like to do is for blocks of riding closer to LT1, I think is a really good opportunity to practice riding in your aero position. So very often I'll prescribe that. Or for some of that middle intensity work, I'll be like, just practice on, practice riding in like your aero breakaway position, and practice doing it to the end of a long ride, under fatigue, as well as, you know, in the situation in a race is you have to ride in aero, focusing on speed, under some amount of fatigue. So is you're not going all out, but say if, especially for a more well-trained person, I think you're still working on much more of like what's going to limit your power output at those high intensities by riding close to LT1 in that position rather than, you know, like 100 to 100 plus watts below it. So that's something I incorporate a lot. I don't do it in VO2 max stuff and quite more rarely for threshold type efforts. And I sometimes prescribe as well, just like say with like a sweet spot session, I'll say like I think under overs are kind of like I don't think you need to do deliberate under overs necessarily, but I also think just doing like efforts out on the road that are more like stochastic is kind of just a more ecological way to do it. So I'll say to someone like ride at this kind of average power, but basically see how fast you can go off that average power. So, you know, you can kind of figure out, does it mean I need to go like way over up the climb or just slightly over and like focus more on aero here and focus less on aero, more on power, and just like really getting good at riding to speed. Because if someone's going to win solo in a breakaway at the end of the race, it's speed is what's going to determine your result, not how much power you put out. And it's really surprising like how much faster putting power out in the right places can make you go versus just like flatlining like you're on erg mode on Zwift. So that's a skill that takes a lot of practice and but is also really important.
Yeah, no, that's a really good session. I like that. And what about if we talk about the really time crunched demographic, so let's say people that have up to 10 hours a week to train, do you have any special considerations for this group?
So I say the first thing to that is like when people are like more time restricted is because they've got other things going on in their life, they've got work, family and commitments and stuff, and quite often it's more the restriction is that you can only take so much total stress, and it's almost less so than the, like in some cases it really is just total time commitment. But I think there's also a large element of it's total like stress, and I think people who are time crunch quite often they'll think, oh, I have to do loads of intensity, and sometimes they even think they have to do some kind of nutritional interventions that are making them more tired for their kind of their family and work life. And quite often what I found with some of my clients is when I've asked them to kind of ride a bit more but also do less intensity and ride easier and fuel better, they find that, like, say one of my clients used to ride sort of 8 to 10 hours a week, and he said I got him riding more but doing a lot less intensity. And one of the things he said to me is, oh, my wife's just now saying to me, you've just got so much more energy now. Like you feel so much less like dead all the time. And because before he was doing the classic thing people do when they first start training, they think, oh, every ride's got to be flat out. And they might not actually be training that effectively, but their training is actually being really detrimental to their work and personal life. So that's one thing I'd say to look out for first is think, is it actually... like, could I train perhaps the same or more training, but do it in kind of a less stressful way that's not affecting my life as much? And I think very often that can be just thinking, because I'm time restricted, I have to do intensity all the time. And I think if anything, you can probably cope with even less intense. Sometimes you can cope. You have to do even less intensity days because you don't have the volume and training history to help you tolerate that. So what we said earlier about riding closer to LT1 on your endurance rides, you can really pin that close, and the trainer is your friend there to help keep that intensity just where you want it to be. I think then also just like being kind to yourself when you have those other stresses, those other life stresses, and maybe you plan to do some hard efforts one day, but actually your work and your personal life ended up being really stressful, then just move that on a day and it's going to work out better in the long run than trying to always push through sessions that you're not feeling good for.
Yeah, no, great points. And a couple of reflective coaching questions here before the rapid fire questions. First, what is something that you're trying to learn more about or focus on at the moment or recently?
Looking into heat training and how to try and best periodize that and like what types of other training you might want to be doing at the same time, what best protocols to use. So yeah, that's something I'm very much looking into at the moment and starting to use with some of my clients, as well as doing it myself.
Yeah, so you said that you actually, as part of your ride today, you finished off with some heat training. And that's quite interesting, because I assume that you're not racing in the heat anytime soon, or maybe I'm wrong about that. Are you?
No, in fact, some of the races, I'm a bit worried that some of the early season races I'm going to have to do in Brittany are going to be a bit cold and wet. But
yeah. So do you do that for the heat training for hemoglobin mass, or?
Yeah. And for increasing plasma volume. So yeah, the evidence, as far as I can see, is pretty strong, and that it can improve performance in temperate climates. I think just the consideration around it is that it's also the type that I'm doing, which I gather from the literature is more effective, where you're actually riding rather than passive heat training, is more effective, but it's also much more fatiguing. So I think you either have to reduce your volume or reduce the amount of intensity you're doing to compensate for that. And then is it better to do concurrently or around when you're doing VO2 max training, so that you get a better response from the VO2 max training, or is it better to save it closer to when you want to have your peak performance and you do all the other work before, and then you just kind of have it as this final novel stimulus to get that extra percent? I don't know. Mm. I don't know if anyone does at this point.
Yeah. No, but I'm curious to hear your results when you have some findings. And if you could go back in time and give yourself some advice around the time that you started cycling, what would you tell yourself?
So there's loads of things. But I'll just say two easy things, which I think are probably important messages. And one of them is just realizing how much you have to eat when you start cycling, because it's quite easy to burn a lot of energy, and I don't think appetite's not always the best to scale with that increase in energy expenditure. So I did run into some problems in just losing weight really fast when I first started cycling, and health consequences as a result. And then I'd also say, I wish I'd started doing strength and conditioning training earlier. That could have prevented some injuries I had. I think that's, even if there's no direct performance benefits, which I think there are of strength training, I think it's, for most people, it's really worth doing for the health and robustness benefits that allows you to maintain consistent training over the months and years.
Was it overuse injuries or traumatic injuries that maybe could have been prevented with bone density?
Yeah, well, so the first injury I had was just with like my patellofemoral pain that went on for like a whole racing season. That's it, meant I never got to like really do any races the first year I started cycling. And then the other injuries I've had, prioritizing good bike fit, that would be my other big important thing. Because the second horrific injury I had was from riding with shoes that were too small for me, ended up having a stress fracture in my navicular bone and stress responses in my first and fifth metatarsal. Because most cycling shoes are too narrow. So what I was having, and I've got very wide feet. So what I was having is that these shoes were, my feet were like splaying over the edges. I ended up, I had to use a wheelchair to get around, because you can't put pressure on either foot. And then it was over COVID time as well. And so the healthcare access, it meant like 14 weeks. I couldn't even walk. And it was, it was mismanaged. And I think if it hadn't been COVID, it would have only been 5-6 weeks, but there was that. And then the other stupid injury I had was just on my brother's like stunt scooter at the skate park. And, this got nothing to do with my advice around cycling, other than don't go on a scooter at the skate park just because your brother tells you to do it, and go down the biggest ramp even when you've told him that's a stupid idea and you don't want to do it. So I broke my ankle then, and that was another sort of thing.
Yeah.
yeah, I've had a bit of bad luck, but yeah.
Yeah. No, cycling can be dangerous, but yeah, I guess that the scooter one was not related to cycling, so at least there's that. Yeah, so let's move on to and finish off with the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer these, and the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
I struggle to think, but I'll try to make something that's useful for the listeners. And I'll say that I think the Long Munch podcast, which I think it's now changed its name to Fueling Endurance. There's so much fantastic advice on there, and it's really helped me. As much as I've learned some things from it, I've also it's really helped me articulate my knowledge of nutrition to my clients as well. So I think that's a fantastic resource.
And what's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
I think just never accepting anything as given, like from regardless of what the information source is, I always sort of question it and think about myself that whether it makes sense to me or not. So
skepticism.
Yeah.
Who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
So I think my nana, who died in 2019, she was always active throughout her whole life and practiced yoga. She was a yoga teacher well into her 80s and used to carry on swimming in the sea. And she was always just kind of like really outgoing, almost to the point of being reckless. And so she's just kind of encouraged me to, I was quite academic. I could have gone down that kind of straight line money earning route, but instead it's like, I want to be a pro cyclist and have a coaching business. I'll do what the hell I want. And that kind of attitude, I think, has come from her a bit.
Yeah, nice. And finally, where can people find you and your coaching business?
So I have a personal Instagram if you want to follow me and my racing, at Marinus Peterson on Instagram. My coaching business, Kilowatt Coaching, is also exclusively on Instagram. I have some, if you want to follow my Strava as well, see some of the crazy training I do. And I have a YouTube channel, which is mostly rubbish, but you might find some of it entertaining. So I think in the future, I'm hoping to do some good, better content on there, but yeah, you might find some of what's on there already. It's interesting.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Marinus. It's been great to chat to you, and hope to do it again another time.
Awesome. Thank you, Michael.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with all of the relevant links that we might have mentioned. And now to the announcement that I teased at the beginning of the episode. Firstly, as it stands, we are very close to full capacity for coaching, which is, of course, great news for us. We have half a handful of available slots only. So if you are interested in having a coach for the 2024 season, which I do very strongly recommend if you want to give yourself the best chance to perform to your potential, then now is the time to reach out, as in a couple of weeks, we might no longer have any slots available. So check out scientifictriathlon.com/coaching and email me at michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And let's see if we might be able to help you achieve your triathlon or endurance goals. Now, secondly, with this in mind, I am starting to look to bring on a new coach to the team. And as a listener of the podcast, you probably already understand how we view coaching. So you already have an idea of what is expected from a coaching standpoint. But what I do want to say as well is that I want to bring on somebody who is prepared to gradually build up their athlete roster or so, but the idea is that within a year or a year and a bit, it would be at least a 40 to 50% job, so coaching 10 to 15 athletes. If you want to have just a handful of athletes on your roster on the side of an already busy full-time job, then this position is probably not for you, because I do think that by coaching a reasonable amount of athletes, you just learn and improve so much more quickly, provided of course that you're doing so with thoughtful consideration. But I'm sure that if you're considering working for us, then you tick that box, and it's also my responsibility in the vetting process to make sure that that is the case. But anyway, it is really important for us to make sure that our coaches are half time at least, or up to full time, basically. So another thing that I want to say is that in the past, when I announce these openings, there are unfortunately very few women that apply. I'd love to see more women apply and give this a shot. So if you're listening to this and not sure if you're qualified, then it's better to just apply and find out, or even just email me and ask, rather than not apply and never know. One more thing is that even if you, as listening to this announcement right now, are not going to apply for this position, maybe you're not a coach or you're not interested in it, if you know somebody that you think might be suitable and interested, then let them know and tell them to give it a shot. And finally, as for how to apply, just send an email to michael@scientifictriathlon.com. You can find the email address in the episode description. Send in your CV and a bit of a background and description of yourself, and I will let you know about the next steps from there. I hope to get lots of great applications. Now, to finish off, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorites. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Zen8. The Zen8 Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Zen8 risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart. Keep loving triathlon.